and any other genres that come our way. For the best in local music, a weekly calendar of upcoming shows, radio interviews, and a live band in the studio every week. Tune in every Thursday afternoons from 4 to 6 p.m. for the Motor Live Drive at 5 show, only on the station making waves, WHFR Dearborn.
Henry Ford College has a medical practice clinical management degree program that will prepare you for a rewarding career in the exciting field of healthcare. You can earn a certificate as a medical office assistant or a two-year degree in medical office management. For more information, give us a call at 800-585-HFCC.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
I'm Chris Moore on WHFR, Dearborn. Thanks for listening.
A very important key in keeping a healthy lifestyle is fitness. Why not condition yourself as well as your mind here at Henry Ford College? The health and physical education curriculum offers both a two-year associate's in applied science as well as a certificate program, both offering a wide variety of courses including exercise physiology, nutrition, and physical conditioning. For more information, you can call 313-845-6318 or on the web at hfcc.edu/programs.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Jennifer Stein. Jennifer is a filmmaker and entrepreneur. Her UFO documentaries have won 4 EBE awards at the EBE Film Festival, held every year at the International UFO Congress in Arizona. She began making films in the 1990s while running nonprofit organizations, raising her 2 children, and running special event business. Her latest documentary is entitled Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton. As our listeners may recall, we had Travis Walton on this show back on June 1st, 2010. His alien abduction incident on November 5th, 1975, was one of the best investigated and documented cases in history, inspiring the movie Fire in the Sky. Jennifer's documentary interviews Travis and other witnesses to the event and presents new forensic evidence that has come to light in the past 40 years. So let's bring her on. Bring her on the line. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello, David. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, thank you for coming on. Oh, and thank you for the DVD. That was quite a documentary. I can see why it won an award.
Well, thank you. So you've had a chance to take a peek at it.
I did. Not just a peek. I watched the whole thing.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, it was a lot of work. It was almost 4 years in the making.
Really?
And I'm very pleased with how it came out myself, and it's done very well so far. It's been screening a lot around the country and even around the world. And, you know, people are very grateful that the true story is finally being told.
Yeah. So give us a little background as to your filmmaking career, or did I already do that?
No, you didn't really, but for any of the listeners, they are welcome to go to my website, which is called On Wings Productions. I'll spell that. It's like a wing, but it's a little more complicated. It's O-N, then W-I-N-G-E, then there's an S for plural, so it's On Wings, and then Productions. That's actually a maiden name. I have a Norwegian maiden name, which is Wing, W-I-N-G-E.
Mm.
So when I got into doing email and creating businesses, I wanted to bring in that maiden name.
Mm.
So I did on Wing, and it just was natural for it to be plural because everyone said, Jen, your projects take flight. And, you know, so I thought, okay, let's use On Wings.
Right.
So I use that for email and my production company. Now, on the website, people can see former productions, which I have done. They're under the title Film Projects. And there's a long list of them there. One of my first projects was about a friend of mine who was a young attorney in Philadelphia, and she was part of a Jewish women's rights organization that I was part of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she went to Israel to just take an interest in learning about, you know, Hebrew and seeing if she could get a job there, maybe working for an American company and going back and forth. And lo and behold, she got caught in a terrorist bus attack.
Oh.
One of the first, at the very beginning, what they call the first flap or the first intifada, which was in 1989. Many people don't remember those details, but she was on a public bus and she lost her life, but not immediately. She survived the initial attack on the bus. And she was, because she was an American and because she was an intelligent woman, an attorney, things like that, like the Nightline News and a lot of, you know, international news people showed up at her bedside and asked her what she thought about what was going on as a Jew and as a lawyer and as a feminist. And she spoke very articulately, and she ended up dying of a secondary problem which developed after the fact. And I ended up making a documentary film about her because I wanted to do something that was created something good from her death, if you can think of that as even possible. I wanted to do something to help lessen the continued retaliation, which is unfortunately, you know, continues to continue in many situations around the world. But there are a lot of positive things that happen in Israel, especially for the Arabs living in Israel and living around Israel. And since those years, Arafat has passed away, and there's been a lot more cooperation, certainly between the West Bank and, you know, what's called Israel proper, or what's now known as the State of Israel. There's a lot more cooperation and collaboration on all sorts of economic developments and things like that, and security. Gaza has been a different story. They've had different leadership. It took, I think, Arafat's death to shift things in Israel. So I'm a filmmaker that tackles difficult projects and difficult issues.
Yeah.
And I do them in meaningful ways that impact people's lives. And that's where my filmmaking career started. So all this goes back to answering your first question, David. I'm sorry it was a long
That is interesting.
That entire film is posted there. It's about a 20-minute film, and it's called Rita's Journey. And it's about that trip to that Rita took and what happened to her and how her friends and family responded. And what this Legal Aid Bureau does, it helps all sorts of immigrant people, a lot of Palestinian women, as well as Arab Israeli women and Druze, whatever group wants to come there and get help. It's a women's center. It's a Legal Aid Bureau, and it's a wonderful public service. It's also a domestic abuse center. The Legal Aid Bureau is part of that center in Carmiel, Israel, which is a central part of Israel, sort of near the Golan Heights area. Mm. So I made that film. It toured the country. It raised about $100,000, and we were from those proceeds able to open a legal aid center in Rita's memory.
Well, that's
so a lot
it.
Of my
that's
films
great.
Have a bigger purpose. It's not just the making of the film, but it's what the film can do, how it can shift or move people forward, and how it can benefit people long range.
Well, you know, you might think, well, that was a drop in the bucket, really, but every drop in the bucket, you know, fills the ocean after a while.
That's right. Lot of people have benefited
and yet
from the services that have provided there in Carmiel. But maybe that had something to do with the beneficial relationship between certainly Jordan and what's now known as the West Bank is cooperating quite a bit now with Israel. So it's only Gaza that we have the serious problems that we've had in the past.
Well, it's like the words of the song, haters are going to hate, you know?
Yes.
But I would say that, you know, yours, along with the other people that have made such positive steps, have helped in this situation. But once again, haters are going to hate. So you went from that. And at what point did you say, ooh, I'm going to do a documentary on UFOs?
Well, I was actually working on a project. I like to collaborate with other filmmakers, and I met a filmmaker here in Philadelphia who was, we were doing a cooking show together. He did stuff for Discovery Health, and I ended up, using my home and some of my camera equipment to help him. And long story short, he wanted to do a project on UFOs, but he didn't know any of the UFO speakers. And I was involved in MUFON already for 10 years at that point. And I said, oh, I can help you. So we actually did a project that we actually had at first green-lighted by Sci-Fi. And this was before UFO Hunters was on the air. It was around 2008. It was called First Contact. We actually posted some of our first teaser episode online, and we got, you know, close to 1 million hits on it. We were hoping it would be a great television show where we were going to have Stanton Friedman, Rich Dolan, and Peter Robbins traveling around the country in an RV investigating UFO stories. And one of the first ones was going to be the 2002 follow-up flap over Washington, D.C., which was exactly 50 years to the day of the flyover in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in 1952, that's where the whole codification of this secrecy, as I like to refer it, around the UFO topics were going on. It was really the beginning of the Cold War, as most of us knew it for the last 20 years and of its life. And it was the beginning of increased funding in black budget projects, which we knew nothing about. And in 1952, there was the Robertson panel that came up with, you know, the closure of the Blue Book projects and the Condon Report. All of those things followed from that period of time.
Right.
And the Robertson panel created what I call a plan for the U.S. government and the military and the Air Force to follow in debunking and ridiculing the entire UFO phenomenon.
Right.
But in fact, it was and still is one of the most profound, I don't know what you want to call it, you know, profound events or phenomenon that is continuing to affect the world over. And I thought that doing this documentary about Travis would be really a great contribution to the education of people who are affected by this ridicule. They're afraid to watch films on this topic. It's not the first film I've done. As I said, we tried to launch this First Contact series. We were working with Larry Landsman at Sci-Fi at that point, and Larry loved it, and he was taking it to his uppers. They loved it. And just about that time, Sci-Fi went under its refinancing. It kind of went bankrupt and relaunched itself and changed its name. The spelling of Sci-Fi changed. I think it used to be SCY, and it changed to SCI.
Yeah.
And a lot of their programming became lower budget productions and things like that. So
yeah.
Unfortunately, this production we had hoped to create got shelved. But it stimulated my willingness and interest to work in that field. So I did a project for Kathy Martin, which is not posted on my my site, but it's called In Their Own Words. And, of course, Kathy Martin is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill.
Right. We've had her on the show.
She came to speak in Philadelphia. I hosted her for a conference for Pennsylvania MUFON.
Mm-hmm.
She was staying at my house, and she had these audio tapes in her suitcase, these little cassette tapes of the original, what would you call it, the original hypnosis sessions that both Betty and Barney had done with a psychiatrist from Harvard named Dr. Simon.
Simon, yeah.
And what Kathy wanted to do is create an audio CD, because people debunked their story, too, and claim it didn't happen and it wasn't real. And this was the closest thing she had to touching that real story, besides the books and things she had written, was these audio tapes, and she didn't know what to do with them. So I took them, digitized them, and narrowed them down from like an hour and a half to like 45 minutes of really good core storytelling of exactly what happened to them from their hypnosis sessions.
All right.
And from that, I ended up working with another film producer whom I've done projects with, including the Travis Project, Bob Terrio, who's in my area. He does video for Merck Sharp and Dohme. And we put together, created a basic video called In Their Own Words, and we basically did it for Kathy practically for free, not completely. We did have some expenses, but we really did it as a project to help her continue to launch the truth that she was sharing about her aunt and uncle and what they experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and her career's taken off
beautifully.
Yeah,
and we're so very proud of her. But she was well seasoned and well ready for the ridicule that she knew she would get.
Sure.
And she befriended and, of course, has come under the wing with Stanton Friedman.
Right.
He had a lot of respect for her. And yeah, Kathy was involved in MUFON for 25 years dealing with abductions and wrote a couple of training manuals of how to deal with, you know, regressive hypnosis and what approach we should take to abductions. She was really a mover and shaker in this area, as well as field investigation.
Mm-hmm.
She helped and contributed tremendously to MUFON's manual on field investigation from her years of work in the topic. And she was a former teacher and she did public service just like Betty had done. So she was really ready to step up to the plate when she came forward.
Right.
And I have so much admiration and respect for her, and I'm very grateful to call her a friend, and we enjoy spending time together. In fact, she'll be with me again. She and Stanton are going to come and do some research at the American Philosophical Society on a new book they're working on about Philip Glass.
Philip Glass. We're going to get into Philip Glass in a minute.
We touch upon him in the film as well.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun. God rest his soul. At the same time, I mean, you know, he was a lot of fun. I got to take just a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. In 30 years, we're just getting started over here. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with a filmmaker, Jennifer Stein, on the Travis Walton film. Travis Walton, tell us... for those who are not familiar with the case, and I think there are a few of those, give us a brief background about Travis and his and that incident.
I would be happy to do that, David.
Right.
And again, for any of the listeners who are listening, they can also go to my website, which is called On Wings Productions, and there's a trailer there, a brief trailer, which is kind of a short synopsis of the film. It's about 7 minutes. So they can see that. But overall, Travis's case is, you know, one of the top 10 UFO cases of all time, because there were just too many people involved and it was too well documented to be negated by the press, as much as people have continued to try to negate it even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So the basic facts around the story is Travis was one of seven loggers working in the Sitgraves National Forest in November of 1975. And their job as contractors for the Forestry Service was to clear underbrush, cut down sapling trees that would inhibit growth of other trees, and to prevent forest fires from happening, certainly in the highest heat months, because there's a lot of lightning strikes that happen in this high plateau region. This is basically the largest ponderosa pine forest in the world. It stretches from central New Mexico through northeastern Arizona and goes all the way up into Colorado. And it sits on a very high plateau that's about 2,000 to 5,000 feet high in various places. So they're finishing their work for the day, putting their chainsaws in the back of a pickup truck. It's about an hour's drive from the closest town, which is called Heber. And they live in a town about 30 minutes away from Heber called Snowflake. These loggers range in age from 28, who was the crew boss named Mike Rogers, all the way down to 17. He was the youngest member of the crew. His name was Steve Pierce. As they're putting their stuff in the truck and they're getting ready to leave, they all climb in the truck. They're starting to drive out of the forest on what's basically considered a path through the forest, a cleared path. It's not really even a paved road. It's not even graveled. It's just a cleared path where they can drive the truck and they're not going to run into a tree or, you know, take the oil pan off on a huge boulder. It's just been a cleared path. It's very rough going. This is a big four-wheel drive work truck. And as they're heading up towards what they call the Rim Road, which is the only dirt path road that eventually leads to a paved road to get out of this forested area, they see a very odd light in the sky, and they don't know what it is. It's actually in the canopy of the tree, so it's not on the ground, but it's not in the sky. It's right at the top of the trees areas. And they think it's a plane crash because there's nobody who lives up there. There's no electrical line strung. It's either that or a campfire that's gotten out of control and, you know, shimmied up a tree and caught the canopy of the trees on fire.
Mm-hmm.
It's odd because it's orange. It's oscillating. It's bright like the sun or a hugely bright moon. It's not dark yet, so the moon's not really up, and they can see the moon coming up, and it's in the opposite direction. So they know it's not the moon. They know it's not the sun setting because that sets in a different area. So they drive up to it thinking they'll know, they'll see what it is, and maybe they can help. And they get to a clearing where they can see the source of this light, and all of them clearly see it. It's like a 25 to 30-foot hovering disc. It's like a flying saucer type UFO. It's clearly a mechanical device from not anything that's made in this country and probably not anything in another country. It's a highly sophisticated machine. It's giving off a huge bright light. They can see the actual structure and framework of the craft through this transparent like shell of the surface of the craft, which is shiny and slightly spinning and oscillating and wobbling a little bit. And it's making very little noise, but it's giving off a lot of light. Travis is sitting in the far passenger's seat in the front, and he's very curious. So he flings open his door and trucks up about 100 feet to be right under this clearing where this craft is hovering in the canopy of the trees. He wanted to get a closer look. He figured it was going to take off instantaneously, and he wanted to just have a completely unobstructed view. And the boys in the truck were yelling at him, "Travis, what are you doing? Get back here." He decides that the craft starts to make an unusual sound, and it frightens Travis as well as all the men in the crew. It starts to make a low, very deep, deep rumbling sound that you can feel in the ground, and some very high-pitched, unusual sounds that are almost above the audible hearing of the human ear, he crunches down behind a log pile that's actually bringing his body a little closer towards the craft, like he jumps forward and next to a logging pile that they had cleared a week before, to so that he could sort of be maybe less in view by the craft, if the craft could see him.
Really?
Which is a concept we put in our language, of course. And then he realizes that maybe this was kind of a stupid idea, and he should probably get back to the truck pretty quickly. So he stands up quickly to run back to the truck, and at the moment that he stands up, he brings his body into a slightly closer range from the craft, probably abruptly, and for whatever reason, the craft reacted and shot a beam out of the side of the craft right into Travis's head and chest. And this lightning bolt-type beam literally picked Travis up off the ground by at least 10 feet and threw him a good 10 feet back. The boys in the truck watching this said it was as if a grenade went off. A couple of them had been in the service, and they said his body flew back as if there had been an explosion, like he'd been hit by a moving vehicle or he had an explosion had gone off. It was a powerful boom that they all felt in their bodies, in the truck, in the ground, and it completely lit up the forest in 360 degrees around them as far as they could see. It lit the forest up like daylight. And Travis, when he landed, made no attempt to break his fall. He landed in a way in which his bones did not look like they were all still connected.
Oh,
it frightened the boys terribly. He just collapsed into a lump that didn't look right, and they were freaked, and they took off. They left because they were afraid that they were next, that the truck was going to get hit by a beam coming out of the craft. They had no idea what was happening. And the crew boss, as Travis says, was being responsible, and he took his men away to safety. So they slammed the door, drove away. They got only less than a half a mile up towards the rim road through the forest, and the crew boss stopped the truck and said, we have to turn around. We have to go back and get him. We cannot leave him here. That was the wrong thing to do. We don't know what this is. We don't know what happened, but we have to go back and get him. So they argue, they get out of the truck, they turn the truck around because he needed help figuring out how to turn the truck around in the forest. By that time, it's almost dark. They drive the truck back to the area where the craft was hovering. They can see the craft at first once they turn the truck around and they're heading back towards it, and then they see the craft take off. So they know the craft is no longer there. So they get back to the spot where the wheels had spun out. They can see where they were parked. They knew the forest well enough to know where they were. They can see basically where Travis was supposed to be. They point the headlights of the truck up there because it's getting dark. They have one flashlight between them. They start hunting through the woods for him and calling for him, and Travis is nowhere to be found. He is not in the spot where they saw him fall. He's not in the spot where he was hiding behind the woodpile. He's not, you know, responding to them. They look in about, you know, maybe to 300-foot circle area around there. They move the truck a couple times looking for him, and they decide they have to get back in the truck and head to Heber and ask for help or try to flag somebody down on the rim road with guns and send them to get help and go back and continue to look for Travis. I mean, they're really quite panicked, and they don't know what the right thing is to do. Some of them have had some brief brushes with the law, either DUIs or some petty theft things, and they're afraid that they're going to end up in jail. No one's going to believe them that they saw this, and they don't know what to say about Travis being missing. They know it's going to be a problem, and they drive it to town, to Heber, which is the closest town. It's about a 45-minute drive. They get there, and one of the men, his name is Kenny Peters, he calls the local sheriff in Holbrook and tells him that they're a work crew and they lost one of their members in the forest that day and they need to report him as a missing person. And they wait there for the sheriff to show up, and that's when this incredible story takes off. This story ends up hitting the news as not only a homicide, as you can suspect. The sheriff thinks that possibly there was an argument, and these logging crew members, who are a rough-and-tumble-looking group, a lot of them have long hair, and their language isn't very pretty, and you know, they're most of them have some education. Most of them have finished, you know, high school, and some of them have some college. But they're, you know, they're from a small town, and their job is, you know, using chainsaws all day, and they like to, you know, drink some beer now and then. And the sheriff immediately suspects that something went wrong. Maybe Travis was accidentally killed, or maybe there was an argument, and or something happened, and Travis didn't go missing by accident. He went missing deliberately, and these boys were responsible.
Yeah. But
so
let me interrupt
you. Immediately the search starts that night. They can't find him that night. A group of them go back. So at 5 a.m., as soon as the sun breaks, a five-day search ensues, and there are over 100 people each day looking for him. They involve the local Navajo tribe. This is, I believe it was Navajo County property that they were on partially. They also have the search and rescue looking for him, the local fire departments, three or four different towns' police departments looking for him, and family members. They call out some dog teams that have two or three different types of dogs also sniffing for Travis, and there's no trace of Travis. He cannot be found. And finally, the boys are being so severely hounded by the marshals and the sheriffs about coming clean about what really happened so they can all go home and get this over with. And they finally agree to take lie detector tests because they're being accused of murder.
Right.
So you never have this in a UFO story. You rarely have seven witnesses, you know, which was the case seeing the craft. And of course, Travis was missing, but six of the boys underwent lie detection tests. One of them was so frazzled by the process because it took all day, and he believed they were setting them up to just arrest them and put them in jail for the rest of their lives, or possibly to send them to the electric chair.
Wow.
Because Travis was missing, and you didn't need to have a body in Arizona at that time to be accused of murder. If you were committed by a jury because of the evidence piled up against you, you could go to the electric chair without necessarily having, you know, proof. Right.
But let me ask you this, Jennifer.
Yes.
Doesn't it seem logical to, wouldn't it seem logical to law enforcement that if they had have murdered Travis, they would have cooked up an excuse that was more believable than, you know, more prosaic anyway, than aliens in a flying saucer picked them up and took them off? Don't you think they would have cooked up some other scheme? And don't you think that would be logical to law enforcement?
Bingo. You're absolutely right.
Right.
Yes. It's not the story you would come up with.
Right.
If there was a murder involved.
Right.
And many people have brought that to the attention of the media. But nonetheless, of course, this is what happened. And much to the polygrapher's surprise, and as well as the local sheriff, Sheriff Gillespie, five of the six men passed the initial exam that was administered that Sunday, which was November 11th, 1975. The one person, his name was Alan Dallas, he was not cooperative. He was convinced that they were asking poignant questions that were going to get him, you know, that he was going to fail this test. He was just very agitated. The questions that he answered on the positive side, but since he refused to finish the test because it was taking, you know, when you take a polygraph test, you have to answer the same question several times, and apparently he didn't understand that, and he lost his temper and said, "I already answered that. Why are you asking me again?" And he ripped off the finger sensors and the cables around his chest, and he walked out. So his test was considered inconclusive, but it's not that he failed the test. As much as he took, he passed, in spite of the fact that he was very agitated. So, and then, of course, what happened later is all of the men were still considered lying about the UFO story, even after Travis was returned. So they took multiple tests to prove their innocence. Wait a minute. Arizona, and some of them even took tests in New Mexico, where it is admissible in a court of law, whereas in Arizona, polygraphs are not admissible for jury material, although they can be part of a case, but how they're considered in court changes.
So after Travis returned, what were the charges?
Well, basically, there were no charges after Travis was returned, except that his community, many people that knew his family,
thought it was a hoax.
Assumed that they made this story up for some unknown reason. And this is where Phil Klass comes in as well.
Okay.
Phil realized the large media attention this story was getting. I mean, ABC News picked it up, NBC, CBS. It was on all the nightly news stations. It was in many major newspapers. The phones were ringing off the hook even while Travis was gone. I mean, people were calling from Russia and Japan and all over the United States. All the UFO groups were crawling all over this case.
Mm-hmm.
APRO at the time was actually had informed Travis's family, if he's returned, don't let the police get a hold of him. Don't take him to, you know, a public hospital and admit who he is. You know, take him under a secret name or take him to a doctors we can recommend who will give you tests in a secure and private environment, because if the military gets a hold of him, you don't know what they're going to do to Travis.
All right.
You know, and so his family was quite alarmed, and the media frenzy at their door, there were cameras and, you know, film crews even then in 1975 outside of Travis's house. So no one accepted that this was really a true story.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened is this media frenzy, and the boys were all young boys. I mean, as I said, they were between the ages of 28 and 17. This is not something you want to make up, certainly to improve your social life, let alone try to get a legitimate job or get into college or have anyone take you seriously.
Right.
So these boys underwent ridicule and, you know, food thrown at them and, you know, assumptions that they were just trying to get out of a work contract, which isn't the case. But none of the boys wanted to go back up to the forest to go back to work after that. And that whole work crew fell apart. Some of the boys left the area. They couldn't handle it.
Mm.
In fact, one of them changed his name and went under an assumed name, took up his middle name instead of his real first name. Steve Pierce went under the name Jim, I think, Pierce for a while and moved to Texas and became a truck driver.
Wow.
John Goulette moved away. You know, only Travis and Mike Rogers continued to stay friends. And, of course, Travis married Mike's younger sister, Dana, and they had a number of children together. So Travis and Mike stayed friends, but even still, it challenged their friendship and their relationships all the rest of their lives.
So how many of these original witnesses were you able to interview for this documentary?
Well, basically, I was able to get four directly, and through archival footage, I was able to include the fifth, which is Mike Rogers. Mike is still a logger in the area, and he has a professional tree service, and he has felt that participation in this topic has been derogatory to his potential business. Certainly his business for the last 40 years, but any future business he could have as well. And he really did not want to get involved in the Travis film project. So I respected Travis's request not to reach out to Mike Rogers. But we were able to speak with Kenny Peters and Steve Pierce. We spent a day with each of them and took them back up to the forest. And John Goulette met us. We were very lucky. We basically met him on a highway and took off through the highway, found a public park, and shot our interview in a public park with him. But we weren't able to take him back to the original site. But he was on his way from a family trip through Arizona, and we met him at a rest stop. And shot that interview with him.
So all but one, right?
Basically, all but one. Now, two have passed away. Alan Dallas has passed away, and so has... I'm blanking on his name. I'm having a senior moment. Two of them have passed, Alan and...
Oh, I see. But you know, all of these guys, including Travis. Now, I guess Travis has taken numerous. I think six lie detector tests, passing all of them. They don't have law enforcement doesn't have a lot of confidence in, it would seem, in the polygraph test. Although, you know, if they give somebody a polygraph test that they flunk it, they say, look, you flunked that polygraph test. You must be lying. But if they pass it, they say, well, they still must be lying. What's the matter with them?
Well, the man who did the polygraph, Cy Gilson, never, you know, said they failed or that they were lying. He actually admitted to me on film, and this is captured in the Travis film, that much to his surprise, they all passed.
That's
so
what I'm saying.
We really need to look at this data. Not only, I mean, UFO researchers have been pointing to this case and this data for years,
right,
saying, look, this is a legitimate case.
Right.
Nobody made this up. But the media has a hard time with it. And the media likes to distort the facts.
Really?
And, of course, the National Enquirer picked up on Travis's story and had stories in their periodicals probably 7 or 8 times. And even the local media, even though they did an attempt to cover it pretty well, there was a local paper called the Holbrook Tribune. And they covered the story, but they covered it with a veil of skepticism.
Sure.
They used the word alleged every time they said, you know, UFO. They wanted to be protective of their reputation.
Well, you know, I must admit that even we UFO investigators have to say, you know, alleged. This alleged witness, this alleged abductee, we don't have that proof right here. Okay?
Right, unless they're an experiencer themselves.
They have to
temper their language or, you know, preface what they're explaining.
Right. But
the public isn't led astray, and there are, of course, too many areas and ways in which we are led astray at times. And these days, with the internet, it becomes very hard to sift through the facts from the fiction and know really what's worthwhile looking at.
But here is all this alleged evidence. What do you make of it? I need to take just one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with independent filmmaker Jennifer Stein, who has made the documentary, award-winning documentary, on Travis Walton. And Jennifer, tell me, does the 1995 movie Fire in the Sky Hollywoodize the incident, or is it pretty much true to the facts?
Well, they did take liberties in the story. Mm-hmm. Travis, at the time, I think it was produced in 1993, if I'm not mistaken, by Tracy Torme, and it was a Paramount film called Fire in the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
They basically followed the story and followed the outline of a manuscript which Travis was about to publish in his own book called Fire in the Sky. So they took the name of that Travis wanted to use as his book title and also used it as the movie title. And they followed pretty true to the story, except that they had 5 loggers instead of 7. And they condensed one of the characters. I did remember one of the other man's name. His name was Dwayne Smith. So there was Alan Dallas and Dwayne Smith, who have both passed away.
Mm.
Now, Travis had a brother whose name was Dwayne as well. And Travis's brother, Dwayne, has also passed away now. So what they did with the 93 film is they condensed some of these characters and some of these personalities into the 5 loggers instead of having 7. They only had 5.
Mm.
And some of the actual events that took place, they changed or they shortened or they simplified. And especially the part where Travis wakes up on board this craft.
Right.
He has come to believe that he was probably healed from an event that was probably accidental, and he was picked up to be brought back to life, most likely. And in that process, he woke up on board a craft, the same craft that he saw in the forest. And he met more than one species of being who were involved in caring for him and probably resuscitating him and restoring him to his own physical health that he has today. But it was during this process that Paramount took the liberty of changing what actually happened to make it look like a much more typical abduction that we hear about, where he's naked and they're probing him, maybe right. possibly taking sperm or other things like that. Nothing like that happened in Travis's case.
Right. It was
Travis also had complete memory
yeah.
of the event. He was also not paralyzed or not controlled telepathically by these beings that he encountered, and that's a typical thing that happens in a lot of abduction cases. And Travis explained that, and Travis also encountered more than one being, and this was very, very early in this data coming out. Very few people talked about this, and it wasn't even really until the late 90s that we started to hear about some of these other abduction cases that were more unique and involved more than one species of being. But Travis encountered a species that looks like you and I, a little bit taller, maybe a little more muscular, goldeny blonde hair, goldeny blue eyes.
All right. The Nordics.
They didn't speak to him. They just led him around by the arm and, basically put him back out to sleep by putting some sort of mask or something over his face that forced him to inhale something that put him back into a suspended state of animation or,
right.
some sort of,
but it wasn't,
like if you're going into the hospital to have some sort of anesthesia,
right.
it blanked out his memory until he woke up on the street. But when he did wake up on the street outside of Heber, he had complete recall. He didn't need regression to remember what had happened to him.
And he wasn't naked like the
And he was not naked like the Hollywood film portrayed.
Right.
But many of the other things that they showed in the film was fairly true to the story. And to Tracy Torme's credit, it was not his intention to distort the film. But when you're a producer working for a big studio, different than in my case, I was working alone and independently, I didn't have the budget, of course, that Tracy Torme had to work with, but I had the liberty and the freedom to create what I thought was a much more true-to-life factual story.
Right.
And I worked very, very closely with Travis trying to make sure that I got it right. And there are a few things that we're tweaking in a more commercial version that we're going to be coming up with. Hopefully by the time of the conference, which will be the 40th anniversary this November, will be exactly 40 years to the day that this whole event took place. And we're celebrating that with a Travis Walton UFO conference in Heber with a number of fabulous speakers. And if people who are listening would like to learn about that, the website for that is called Skyfire Summit. And we'll be showing either this film that is currently out now, or we'll be showing a slightly tweaked commercial version, which has some improved reenactments in it and has some slightly different archival footage, because I'm having some rights of the original archive footage I've used, although I thought I had clear understanding with the owners of that footage. Apparently I did not, and I'm limited in the commercial rights I can use their footage. If I wanted to sell this to a network or put it in some art houses, get it into some movie houses, things like that, charge any kind of admission for it, I have to have permission from any other footage I use that's not my own.
Right.
And one of the suppliers of the footage is confused about what I'm doing with his footage. And so I think I have to just replace his footage. But I found some other wonderful footage I can use from some other productions that were done in the late 70s, early 80s, and even into the 90s. So.
Will Travis Walton be presenting at this Skyfire Summit?
Yes, he will.
Yay.
And we have a number of great speakers who will be there. Ruben Udiarte, who is from... MUFON in Northern California. He will be presenting. And let me think. I'll go to it real quickly and see who our speakers are, because I don't remember them all right offhand, but okay. I'm right in front of my computer. So let's see, speakers.
So where can they go?
David Childress is going to be there. Oh. He's also an Arizonian, lives in Payson and is not too far away. We have Leo Sprinkle, who will be coming, who has been involved in the University of Wyoming for a long time. He's a PhD, and he is one of the leading psychologists who has really addressed the whole abduction experience for people through a very professional approach with hypnotic regression, studying this effect like John Mack was doing. Then we have Lee Spiegel, who appears in our film. He's a writer for the Huffington Post. He's a very well-spoken reporter, and I have so much respect for Lee. And if anyone has not heard his presentation on the history of UFO disclosure and some of the things he brings to light as a newspaper reporter, I think you're in for a great treat. We have Tracy Charme, who produced the original Skyfire film that Paramount produced in 1993. And Ben Hansen, who is also in the film and whom I've worked closely with. Ben has helped us with our facts and with our forensic research. And Paula Harris, who is a fabulous presenter, she's written many books, so she's a many-time author. She lives in Boulder, Colorado, and she's both Italian and American, and she has dealt with this issue on an international level. And Lynn Katai will be there presenting.
Wow.
And many people know Lynn Katai is the producer of the Phoenix Lights documentary.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for Lynn. We have become good friends over the years.
Okay.
And another film producer, James Fox. I will be there as well. I'm not presenting, but I am showing the film. So I'm not speaking, but I'll be there as a panel of other filmmakers. And then we have Noe Torres, who will also be presenting. And Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte have been co-authors on a number of books together.
Right.
They've written a book about the Mexican Roswell, and also Real Cowboys and Aliens. So it should be a very interesting conference. And we have Alejandro Roes, who is going to be our MC for the whole conference.
We're running short of time, but there's a couple questions I wanted to get in briefly. Has any of the principals involved in Travis Walton case ever changed their story since 75?
They have not. One of them almost changed their story because he was being chased by Phil Klass and offered $10,000 to say this didn't really happen. And he was, you know, a young 19-year-old and needed the money and considered it. But he never changed the story. His family said, you can't do that. That's dishonest.
All right. Well, you know, it makes you wonder what, who was Phil Klass and why was he so intent on, debunking the credible UFO stories?
Right. It's a good question. And where did he get $10,000 in 1978 or 79?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money then. It's like close to $250,000 today.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he must have had a backer. And who could that backer have been?
Yes.
Anybody's guess. But,
yes.
I'm not going to point any fingers, but I have pointed fingers on this show quite often.
And we address that issue in the film.
Right.
Anyone who gets the film or comes to one of the screenings we're having can see how we deal with Phil.
Right. And what new forensic evidence has come to light since the incident?
Well, while we were up in the Sitgraves Forest going back to the original site, and we actually did a site survey with metal detectors and things, and we examined the trees. We did some more sampling of the trees. We found, as Travis has known for a good 20 years, we know that there was accelerated growth rate in the trees right around where the craft happened. But this was partially my discovery and Ben Hansen's as well, and we finally pointed it out to Travis so many times that he said, you know, I think you got something there. I think you're onto something. Hmm. We discovered that the accelerated growth rate was not uniform through all four sides of the tree. There were probably 15 to 25 or maybe even 60 trees affected. But what we discovered is the accelerated growth was more accentuated on only one side of all of these trees, and that varied with each tree and was different with each tree. And the accelerated growth was pulling epicentrically towards the center of where that craft had been located. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't be from sun or from water or from, you know, all pointing north or something like that, or from some magnetic radiation that was coming out of the ground in that area. That would have affected the growth differently if it was, in fact, radiation that's causing it.
Right.
And we found some other white papers done on Chernobyl, which showed that the five-mile radius around Chernobyl, pine trees called Scott pines, very similar to the ponderosa pine, almost its cousin, it's basically the same tree, those trees grew at a 33% accelerated growth rate for a good 15 to 20 years.
So the answer is
radiation. That's exactly what we have found here.
The answer is radiation.
We think that it's caused by radiation. That's at least what this white paper believes, because of the way trees grow and the way they react to radiation.
Right.
It stimulates their growth. Mm-hmm. But it's only stimulated growth on a different side of each of these trees surrounding this epicentric area where the craft was.
Yeah. Too bad we can't put one of those trees into a polygraph test, you know?
Yes. Yes. And wouldn't that be interesting?
Wouldn't it? You know, like the fly on the wall. Has Travis had any other abduction experiences since the original one in 75?
He does not... he gets asked that question a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And usually he gives a very sarcastic answer.
Okay.
Like, if I did, I certainly wouldn't talk about it. I think in my personal view of having gotten to know Travis pretty well, I do not believe that he has. He has had some sightings, but he's not one of these people that has ongoing abductions or many, many people in his family all abducted. This was a one-time event that happened to Travis.
Okay.
And he has recently seen some different type of craft, actually a large black triangle, which he has spoken openly about when he does interviews and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also important to realize there was a large flap of events which have taken place in Arizona in that period of time, in northern Arizona and southern Utah, right around that period of time. And even the Sheriff Gillespie, confessed to seeing and having reports being given to him by other people during that period of time, within a 2-3 year time period, both before and after Travis's event.
Hmm. But he doesn't recall any other abduction experiences. Or at least he won't, like he says, he wouldn't admit it, right?
Correct.
Well, you know, you go through that. I don't blame the guy, you know. So.
Oh, me too. Me too. Who would want to,
yeah.
Right?
Right, right, right. So, okay, once again, the name of the film, the documentary, is Travis Walton, Travis, the true story of Travis Walton.
Right.
And once again, where can people go to... learn more about the film?
Well, a really easy way is just type in Travis Walton, themovie.com.
Mm.
Travis Walton, themovie.com. It's not Travis, the movie. That's a different movie.
Right.
Travis Walton, themovie.com. And they can get right to my website. They can purchase the film there. They can learn about it. They can jump over to the Skyfire Summit conference website. They can learn about how to sign up and go up to that. It'll be a great experience. We're going to take people up into the woods where the event happened. So it should be a lot of a very, very interesting and very unique opportunity to be with a small group of people. You know, we're probably only going to be 150, maybe 200 people at this conference.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's the Skyfire Summit Conference.
Yep, skyfiresummit.com, and the movie is Travis Walton, themovie.com.
But the summit is on November the 5th, 2015?
Correct, correct. Mm-hmm. This November 15th. I'm sorry, this November 5th, 2015.
2015. And they can go there by going to what URL?
www.skyfiresummit.com.
Skyfiresummit.com.
Uh-huh. But if they go to my website, there's also a link to it. They can find it.
Give your website again.
TravisWaltonTheMovie.com or On Wings Productions.
On
Both
Wings.
Both will take you right to the same spot.
And the wings have the E-S instead.
Yeah, it's O-N-W-I-N-G-E-S, like in Sam.
Right,
On Wings
right, right.
Productions.
Right, right. Very good. And Jennifer Stein, thank you so much for joining us. We are not alone. And best of luck with the Skyfire Summit and with the documentary.
Thank you, David. It's been my pleasure to be your guest. I hope we can do it again soon.
I hope so. Okay. Very good. And goodbye for now.
Bye.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to whfr.fm, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR, Dearborn.
You guys and dolls out there, you're at the Malt Shop with Daddy G. And here on WHFR, that FM making waves. And we're going back to the 50s and 60s when rock and roll was just getting started. We're going to drop a dime in that record machine and spin some platters. So grab your favorite squeeze, hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, and head on down to the Malt Shop. And here we are, back in the 50s.
Boogum, 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 boogum now, baby, you're casting your spell on me. I say boogum, 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 boogum now, baby, you're casting your spell on me.